This is David Simmons, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 24th of September 2012.
Yes, my name is David Simmons, if that's sufficient. Sutton, Surrey is the place of birth, and my date of birth was 31st of March 1933.
So you're now 79?
Yes.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
Oh, yes. Yes, he
Tell
was.
Tell me about him.
He was an engineer, civil engineer, got his degree at Bristol.
What sort of things did he build?
Well, by the time I was aware, he was with the London County Council in the old days when it was everything went on through the London County Council. And he was in there, in fact, in their drainage department. Because I can remember during the war when there were blitz and things, he had to do duties in London every now and again.
What, repairing the damaged sewers?
Well, more supervising. He wasn't a, you know, he was an office. It was an office job, as it were, and yeah. He inspected things. And
what about your education, David? What sort of schooling did you have?
Oh, straightforward grammar school and Birmingham University.
Which university?
Birmingham.
Birmingham. Studying?
Physics.
Oh, right, OK. when did you first learn that there was a place called the Antarctic?
Oh, I'm probably aware of it at the time, but when I was... I think probably just after I'd graduated and had found a job, what with the Transantarctic Expedition and the Royal Society's Halley Bay expedition, which wasn't a Bass or a Fitz thing, one couldn't really be aware, well, if you... not be aware that these things were going on, and I looked at these and thought, "Oh, yeah, I'd like to do something like that."
What was the attraction, David?
It'd be difficult to describe. Something different, something exciting. I was keen on hill walking and things, you know, outdoor activities, so it fitted in.
Had you read about Scott and Shackleton and...
No, very little. I read about them on base, of course, because there were books there, but no, I wasn't at all knowledgeable on it. At least not that I remember.
Did you have a job after university, or did you go straight to FIDS?
No, I had a job.
What was that?
And with a Scientific Instrument Research Association, it was there that I became, whilst that period, whilst I was working there, that I became aware of all the Antarctic things going on, and thought, have a go at this, and applied and got the job.
So did he see an advert, or did he just write up and hope for the best? Did you see an advert for a job, or did you write?
I'm not quite sure how that worked out, but I was aware. I can't remember now. What that was, I can remember. Yeah, going up for the interview.
Tell me about the interview.
Well, in fact, there was one I failed, which was for the Royal Society.
Oh, you'd applied for them?
Thing, and that was with a great big panel of people in the... somewhere... what's the name of the place where the Royal Academy is, in that collection of buildings. But then I saw the FIDS one and all the... yes, it would have been FIDS then, wouldn't it? Falkland Islands Dependency Survey. I saw their advert and was successful on that one.
What were you applying to do? What was the job you were applying for with FIDS?
That was just scientists, because what was going on then was very little research work by people who went to do it for their interest. It was all a question of collecting data that went to all the various institutes that it was at. And that was particularly the case where I was, on the Argentine Islands, where I think we'd had almost any sort of physical measurement thing was possible then. We were given it to do, because it was a static base. And so there was, in fact, ozone in those days, magnetic measurements, seismic measurements, tidal measurements, and all sorts of odd, and a few other odd things.
How was your journey south?
Well, that was interesting, because I was on the maiden voyage of the John Biscoe, sailed out from Southampton, and curiously, well, at least once the weather got reasonable, we seemed to be engaged in painting the outside of it, which struck me slightly strange when it was a new ship, but it certainly needed painting and keeping order. But I suspect from a sort of looking back at it, I suspect this was also all part of the get people to work together. And so it was a fairly normal thing that was done on all the trips. You know, they were...
Teamwork.
Yes. Although it was... I've got pictures of people in the hot weather holy stoning the decks, if you're familiar with what that is.
So what year was this, David?
56. So I spent the whole of 57 and 58 in the Antarctic, and some of 56 getting there, and some of 59 coming back.
Did you know before you went which base you were going to go to?
Oh, yes.
It's Faraday, wasn't it?
Well, now called Faraday. Yeah. It's called Argentine Islands. But it was the only one that had that style of work being done. It was the only one that I would have, I didn't want to go just as a sort of, I wouldn't say gashan, but you know what I mean. I wanted to go to do something that at least, from the point of view of professional, not advancement, but at least I could have been said to have been doing appropriate work for a graduate physicist.
Tell me about approaching the Argentine Islands. What was it like?
Well, that goes a bit, because we spent some time on the way down and some time on the Falkland Islands. But I got to Argentine Islands with hardly any... unlike many others, stopping at hardly anywhere else at all. So I didn't really see... I think we went into one, W Island, Horseshoe, which was a bit further south, and I think that was when... I'm not sure whether we actually saw the Royal Yacht, but certainly the Protector, or whatever the naval ship was that was around them. That would have certainly been around with the Protector, because Philip was doing his...
Prince Philip?
Of the Antarctic, amongst other things.
Did you see him?
Yes. He... there was a lunch on the... on the Biscoe, and there was Philip, and there was, trying to think of the table I, because there were several tables, sat with No, the name's gone, but he was a physics person, or a science person.
Fids had a lunch on board the Biscoe for the Duke.
Yeah. As far as I can remember, yes.
What was the Biscoe like in its first maiden voyage? Was it a smooth and comfortable voyage, or...?
Going down, yes. I don't know, there were some perhaps rough times, but I don't remember. I'd done a bit of sailing before, and so, you know, I wouldn't have been... I might not have felt very well, but I wouldn't have been put out by bad weather. That's what you expect sometime. And whether the crossing, which is liable to be very uncomfortable, between Falkland Islands and Cape Horn and the Antarctic Peninsula, I don't think on that occasion it was an uncomfortable trip at all. I don't remember also the, you know, first sight of the Antarctic in the distance.
What was it like? You hoped?
That was the peninsula, so that you see the hills and the ice and things.
You said to Amanda that the scenery was something that you really appreciated.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
What was so special?
Well, it was just... I'll show you some pictures. You've probably seen them, but I'm not sure how to describe it, but it was just magnificent. I'll fish out something.
No, don't worry. I'm trying to get the words.
Now that's more difficult.
It is. You've got it right.
I was already keen on photography and landscape photography, so that was ideal.
Talk me through the arriving at Argentine Islands. Talk me through the arrival and what you had to do.
We'd spent some time in the Falkland Islands over Christmas, but got to Argentine Islands seeing very little else on the way, which was a little bit unusual, and because we'd gone down to, I think, liaise with Prince Philip and his party, and then went on to where I got off, as it were, and it's on this island about 5 miles off the Antarctic coast, and well, ship ties up or whatever it does there, you get off, and usually there's a lot of work done, all manual work with the cargo to keep the base going, running up and down the beach or whatever it was, and that's all in those days is entirely manual.
Were you able to get your scientific programmes underway straight away?
Oh, they were already working. Somebody had been down there the year before and made a very good job of setting things up, and then had had a furious row with the authorities and resigned. And so the place was, I think, had been empty. But I was the assistant to her. Scientist, a chap called Joe Farman, you've probably heard of him. He was the senior, and that was, you know, that was sort of laid down. Mostly people are fairly done fairly equally, but
So there was no real handover period then for the scientists. There was nobody to show you the ropes.
Well, that would be the normal situation. Well, and Joe Farman had got there a month, possibly more, before I did on a different ship, and so there wasn't any problem there. He probably had to find out what, because there wouldn't be somebody handing over. I think it was, you know, vacant for a while.
What was the hut like in 56, 57?
Oh, I found quite comfortable. I mean, there was one big dormitory room with enough bunks for everybody, about 12 or 14 people. And you did get ice if bits of were left for ventilation, or even if it was cold, you know. You did get ice and things inside. But there were anthracite stoves and around, and that was no problem. There was a sort of communal, not sure what you call it, lounge isn't quite the right word.
Mess room,
that's, yeah. That's the right word. And then there was sort of the radio operator office, and the Met people had their Met office. And then we had our instruments, some, the ozone one of which was actually on a roof structure.
So how did that work?
Well, you've got this huge and very heavy machine, which the previous chap had made a beautiful mounting for, and it hung from, not quite from the ceiling, but from this little sort of tower that got put on, and you swung it round, and it was, on sunny days at least, it was sometimes a bit frustrating, because when you might want to go out and do something, you usually expected to take more observations, and you sort of pointed the optical bit at the top at the sun or whatever it was. I forget just what all the different observations were, but it was to look at the ultraviolet light coming in, this rather splendid instrument designed by... the name's gone. Professor somebody at Oxford University. Dobson.
Dobson, yes.
No, Dobson. Well, then. Dobson, well, then. spectrophotometer.
Tell me about some of the chaps on bass.
It was a very mixed group, particularly the first year, in that there were quite a few old hands from different backgrounds. There was somebody who'd got a basic Met Office observer. There were few, if any, I'm not sure that Joe and I weren't the only graduates. There was a diesel mechanic and a wireless operator, and unlike some bases, we had a full-time cook who had Sundays off, and we took it in turns to do that on Sundays. There was a diesel gent, there was somebody looking after the diesel engine. Somehow that made up about five Met people, because of the number of things they were launching, the radios on balloons, which can be, in bad weather, quite a, a procedure. But that's all of which and all the things we were doing, I'd been to Shetland Islands as part of the training, which was nothing to do, as some people imagined, with getting fit or anything. It was because the observatory there had all the things that we'd got in the Antarctic and were doing to learn how they worked.
So before you went south, you went north then to
the Shetland Islands. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, describe the facility there, please. What do you remember of that place where you were training?
quite fascinating. Lerwick is the capital, and then about a mile, 2 miles, I don't know. I can remember in those days I'd have walked it from the town, but on a hill, but it was fairly flat, and it was a, I'm not sure what the meteorologist would call it, but it was one of about three in the country meteorological observatories or something, where they went in for, and there was the magnetic work that got separated and eventually the more appropriate people in the Met Office dealt with that. But there were the magnetic measurements, the ozone measurements. They were the two biggest, and various other odd things.
But FID sent you there to train specifically?
In the instruments, yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes, nothing to do with it being rigorous, you know, arduous or anything like
Not
that.
Not survival training.
No. And I'm not quite sure what the arrangement was, but there was accommodation and meals provided on a mess basis.
So when you went down to Argentine Island, the equipment was familiar.
Oh, there was nothing that I hadn't.
Right.
And you know, it was well organised, so I don't think there was. I think we had a tide gauge that we perhaps installed, but it's a fairly basically simple thing, and clearly there wouldn't have been one of those.
So there was no real need for a handover as such?
Well, no, not too much need. Yeah. Well, it was particularly important then, because I think this chap who'd resigned had left, I think he must have come out again the same time he went. No, I'm not quite sure, because he did quite a bit of work too. But then there's quite a long period between the first visit and the last.
So the ozone measurements you were doing, I guess you had no idea at that point how valuable they would become.
Oh, no, no.
So just tell me a bit more about what you were measuring.
It measures the ozone content in the upper atmosphere by comparing the absorption of several different quite narrow wavelength bands of ultraviolet light as they came through, because they'd been differently absorbed. And so according to the amount of ozone, there'd be a different comparison of the absorption of two different wavelengths, one of which was affected and one wasn't. Roughly, that's, I think that's what it was.
And how are you reading these measurements? What was it coming up on a screen? Or?
Oh, heavens, not in those days.
Well, how was it done then?
That was entirely a wonderful machine. mechanical, as it... No, that's not quite the word. But it's I think there is a proper technical name for that sort of spectrophotometer, I forget what it is. But one had to, there was just a sensitive galvanometer, meter, and you had to center that by adjusting the absorption on one of the wavelengths or something like that. And so there was this needle that was wobbling about, and you had to try and keep it on that centre line, and because of the nature of this is going back a bit for not electronics but for electrical measurements, and the way of that measurement was got onto record was you sat there twiddling this thing to try and keep the needle, fairly still. And what you'd put on a circular disc, which was part of that, was a smoked plate, and there was a little needle thing. And a clockwork bit on it. So as you did this, you scratched a little message, as it were, in the smoke, on the smoke plate, because it, scratched it off, just blank. I think it was probably a little paraffin lamp or a candle or something. You just went like that with a sort of yellow flame that produces black stuff, and you coat a disc and with that.
So you were smoking your own plates?
Oh, yes.
And then you reuse the same plates again, would you?
Oh, yes, yes. Okay. Yes.
And
just record the... I forget what we've recorded. I think we'd then take these away and read them I don't remember all the details, but that was a fascinating. And that, I think that by the time I went back again, I think there was a different method. That was quite old-fashioned, but then, there wasn't electronics in those days.
So when you got this smoky plate with the marks in it, scratch in it, were you then measuring them with a slide rule or a ruler or...?
Yeah, something like that.
Against the graph?
Not quite.
But you were coming up with a figure?
Oh, yes, we're coming out with a figure, yes, yeah. That we put in a number, yeah.
And would the ozone density fluctuate a lot?
Oh, yes, it did vary quite a bit.
From day to day or hour to hour? Or?
Well, I think there was a daily variation, but that's not something I dealt with when I came back. The two had been separated. I don't remember all the all the technical details.
Was there anybody on base you got on particularly well with, you have fond memories of?
I got on particularly well with, I think, with the cook the first year.
Who was?
Jerry
Cutland?
Yes, right, Jerry Cutland, who later became a steward on the ships, and he was there for the first year. And in fact, I got such a nice picture of him because he seemed to get on, that it's been used in an American's book about Antarctic food.
Oh, right. he has a reputation for being a very good chef.
Oh, yes, he was. Well, he was very good at... what's the word? Improvising and producing good results from whatever he was given. And, even if he had to find out. He'd been a... I think he'd done... was it one of these vans? He'd done some catering, but not on a high scale in the West Country, I think. Possibly even on a vehicle,
So you ate well. You ate well.
Oh, yes, I think we did, yes. And depended a bit too, because there was quite a variation in what people would eat. Some would eat anything that would, which I tended to be in that group, and then there are others that would turn their nose up at all sorts of things. We ate seal meat not reasonably often, and that was, I think you might have been difficult to have been justified just for us, but we'd got a couple of pensioned off sedge dogs, and they needed feeding as well, so the seals were killed for that. And somehow penguins were tried, but somehow the sort of, what's the word, attitudes... Nobody really wanted to, other than perhaps to try it and see. We did have cormorants, and the cook was extremely good in. We'd shoot one or two and hung them up, and they made very good food.
And but penguins are too friendly to eat, were they?
I think so. It was just something in the culture that... Oh, they would try, but no, it wasn't at all common.
I need to ask you about some of the other readings you were doing. So tell me about the tidal readings. Was that a daily reading or hourly? Or
I'm not sure we needed to go and read that, or whether it recorded onto a drum. I don't remember.
But it was obviously something down on the water's edge, wasn't
it? Oh, yes, it was.
Like a ball cock?
Just a cylindrical tube with something floating in it. It went up and down, and there was a bit of wire and something else with a pen marking something or whatever it was. Don't remember it.
Geomagnetism, were you reading those, taking geomagnetic readings as well?
Do I?
Were you taking geomagnetic
readings? Oh, yes, that was... That was one of the main things.
Tell me what you can remember about that.
What I...
Tell me what you remember about
Well, just it.
Sorry, just, I should speak.
Just the volume a bit. That had a separate hut a few hundred yards away from the main hut, which was entirely non-magnetic. And when we went over to it to take the measurements, we had to make sure we weren't wearing anything steel, you know, metal that would do that. And there were three instruments. You measured what direction it was and how strong it was, both vertically and horizontally. And you had static instruments that did... You went and took these measurements two or three times a week, I think it was. But then the main measurements were... And the other part of the same non-magnetic hut, where you had drums with photographic paper, and you had these little magnets and you know, suspended and beams of light, and these recorded onto the photographic paper that was turning round. So at the end of each day, we had a piece of photographic paper about that big with lots of little wiggly lines on it. And then you had to look at these compared to the readings to see what the position was or what the size was. And so those were done every day. And in fact, we chose, or Joe chose, he was quite happy with, 12 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, to change them, so they were standard, which meant it was 9 o'clock in the evening when we changed them. And I think we managed to do that regardless of weather. I don't think we fell down on that one, which was quite a business, because it was, you know, some little way away from the thing, and not particularly simple flat route, but
you take readings from these photographic plates as well, and were they then just stored up and taken back to the UK?
Yes.
So those readings were not sent off in Morse code, or was the radio man not relaying the readings to somebody, Stanley?
No. I think that was. May have been some measurement of an indice of how disturbed it was. And there may have been some summary, you know, it was all pretty quiet and still, or it was doing that. But I don't... But then the radio contact was very limited in those days. I mean, I think we had one airmail message from family of not more than a couple of hundred words or something, once a month or something, because that's one of the biggest changes, of course.
Did he go into the radio room much?
Not a lot, no. Chat and got on with him, but occasionally go and there was something particular. Might be a few people there listening to. But it was mostly... Morse rather than voice. So
were you able to pick up the BBC?
Yeah, I think we did pick up something. Yeah, but I'm not very sure. I'm uncertain about that one.
So did you find the work you were doing, this routine readings and recordings work, was interesting, or did it get boring?
Yeah, no, I found it... sufficiently interesting and sufficiently given the feeling that you were doing something useful, because the people that wanted these results, you know, when you'd taken them, so you were taking stuff that you believed to be
worthwhile,
useful and worthwhile, as the ozone turned out to be.
Well, very much so, yeah. So do you think you were... I'm sorry, Dan. Do you think you were aware of the... the fact this is part of a bigger plan, that the International Geophysical Year...
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, that was what it, you know, what it was all about. And so there were some things probably we did on forms for the IGY. I can't remember the all the details.
Would you be in touch with other bases doing similar work to yourself?
No.
No. So you really were quite isolated then?
Oh, yes, in that sense, yes, yes. I mean, there were other places doing it. In fact, there were quite... Not so many on the magnetic side, I think, but on the meteorological side, everybody wanted... although the meteorologists, there were five of them, they were separate and they looked after their business, although we might occasionally have helped them. Sometimes a bit of extra hand was needed to try and get the thing up in the air without hitting the ground.
Or the radius on.
Doing things. Mm.
Did this isolation bother you at all? Did you miss the rest of the world?
No, it didn't bother me particularly, no. I think it might have some people, but... And I don't think it did many of the people there. They wouldn't have been there, I don't think, if that was likely.
So apart from work, how else did you occupy your life, your time?
Well, there was music, you know, record player. I took music down, put records down, you know, old
78s?
No, they were 33, but they weren't not stereo in those days. And whenever the opportunity, put on your pairs of skis, because it was an island, but it was a couple of hundred feet to the top of the hill. And so there was plenty of opportunity to go skiing and skiing down and to, when the sea ice froze over, to move to some of the other islands. So there was plenty of opportunity to get on your skis. In fact, we probably had to get to the magnetic hut on some conditions. Can't remember.
How much attention did you pay to health and safety in those days?
Well, in any formal sense, of course, none, but in the sense of behaving sensibly and being aware that you were in a dangerous place and therefore acting accordingly, we were, you know, quite aware of it, but it is not in any formal way.
Did you have any scary moments?
Yes, possibly. There was certainly one case when I was going round, and I think I was walking and not on skis, and the bit of ice, but just ice on round the base, round the island somewhere, wasn't strong enough, and I went through, but I went through to somewhere where I was standing up, up to about here, and pulled myself out. And I'd got so many layers, I think, then... that in the brief time I was there, it sort of didn't penetrate to the inner level, so it wasn't really it wasn't particularly scary, but just a bit. I think, oh, that would have been careful.
And was there any? Because you were there for two seasons, I think, weren't you?
Yeah,
yeah.
The two of us did that. We were the only two, I think.
You and Joe. And
Joe, yeah.
Joe Farman,
yeah. Yeah.
Were there any really, really bad weather patterns? Any bad blows?
Oh, yes. Yes, you get some with huge amounts of drifting.
How did the base get on as a group? First year, second year?
I think the second year, the Met team particularly seemed to get on quite well. But there was a slightly higher proportion of graduates just sometimes just wanting to do something in the Antarctic that made up the Met team. No, I think by and large we got on reasonably well.
First year?
Yeah, I think so.
Were there any any arguments or disputes?
Oh, well, there were those. I imagine, although I don't remember those. I don't remember.
It's a very strange thing to do, isn't it, to go to the Antarctic for 2 years and to lock yourself away and
Well, I don't know.
Be a scientist.
Antarctic in the IGY period with everybody, it was full of people doing that.
Were you aware of Vivian Fuchs's expedition?
Oh, yes, yes. He was certainly aware of what he was doing. I'm not sure whether we would have kept up with his progress or not. And I'm not quite sure how the timings were. It was about the same time, but I'm not quite sure how it fitted in.
Tell me about some of your trips out then. Where would you go on your skis?
Well, mostly it was up to the top of the hill and or round the islands or round the... there were two or three islands quite close together.
Was there somewhere...
One occasion only, I think. Because we don't think we're anything like as... Well, adventurous perhaps isn't quite the word. But we're about 5 miles off the shore, off the peninsula.
Yeah.
And so... skied over on when it was, you know, really solid to climb up not a very big hill, Cape Tuxen, I think it was called, which was quite a time we'd done that, and if the sea ice was a little got a slight salt content, then you didn't slide through all that easily, so I was completely exhausted when you got back. And also we had boats, and so we went on little trips round to other islands, and we went up to Petermann Islands, where there were some Argentines, and sort of had a couple of visits to them, and they visited us. But I think that was... I think they're only there in the summer, and I don't think that one stayed there. That place stayed.
Did you get on with the Argentines?
Oh, in what little was, oh yes. There may even have been the... I'm not even sure whether that would have happened, but it was quite often perhaps that protest notes for the, you know, each were swapped and then you'd sort of put them away and have a party.
So Jerry would be catering for the Argentinians from time to time, would he?
Oh, I think they probably only came once or twice up, and I don't know whether that would have been...
But how did the British food compare to the Argentinian food? Did you get steaks?
I have no idea.
You have no idea? It's a long time ago. I appreciate all that. Yeah. You say that the challenges were more personal ones than physical ones. Was this about becoming a man growing up, or what did he mean by that?
Well, perhaps just being around with all that's involved mentally, and perhaps if you don't get on with everybody, then that's, you know, because that's more difficult to do with the one can really... look at the question, well, if you've got the right clothing and the things, then there isn't a problem. I mean, not everybody would agree, but that's how it seemed to me anyway.
As the time came to sail away again, in fact, you didn't sail away, did you? I think you left by another means of transport, didn't you?
Yes, I did. For some reason, because of the logistics of getting the right number of people on boats and things, HMS Protecting, I think that was the naval ship, was some 5 or 6 miles away, but they sent a helicopter over and I was packed off onto this helicopter and then spent at least 2 or 3 weeks on Falkland Islands before the Pisco then because I went back, same ship, to England. Did a bit of walking around the Falkland Islands.
Just talk about this helicopter ride. Any spectacular...
Oh, yes. There's something called the Lemaire Channel, which is where you've got two great hills and a channel through. We went actually through between those in the helicopter, which was quite fun.
It's now nicknamed Kodak Alley, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Probably, yes.
Yeah. So you flew to the Protector and then she took you back to the Falklands?
Yes, yes.
That's right. And so you had some time on the Falklands. So tell me about the Falkland Islands in the 1950s. What were they like?
Difficult to describe. Primitive's not really the word, because it's almost entirely English people that have... Well, the... Two or there would be three different groups. There was the Colonial Office people, and I'm not quite sure how many that would have been, but there have been quite a few, and there was the governor of the Falkland Islands. There was the Falkland Islands Company, which owned, I'm not sure they do own as much now, but owned probably more than 50% of the sheep farming land on the place. And then there were the... what you might didn't quite call them indigenous people, but you know, they'd
locals,
they'd settled. No, I mean, they or their families had settled on the Falkland Islands from quite a few from Scotland and a few from Wales. And I can remember at the time being slightly shocked, isn't quite the right word, but not being entirely approving in that they were treated by the Colonial Office and, you know, Government House parties or something. Socially, there were three, considered to be three very, very different groups. And we somehow fitted in with the government people, I suppose, which is what we were. But the, what one, indigenous isn't really the right word, but, you know,
The settlers.
Natives, but yeah. The settlers, that's the right word. They were definitely on a lower class, and I can remember thinking that this was really a bit off for it to be as obvious as it was, that there was a social distinction between the different groups.
So there was a clear class system?
Oh, yes.
Was there?
Well, as far as the government house went, yeah. And for doing when it was doing parties or something...
So how would that manifest itself? Would people not talk to each other in pubs?
It may have only been in garden parties and things that the government house run. I'm not quite sure. I did... No, I could have described, you know, what life was like there, and I was staying, or coming back, you know, saying... In digs, basically, on some quite nice lady that lived in a house by herself. And I think it had come from Scotland. There seemed to be the classical pictures on her wall of... would have been Queen Elizabeth by then, wouldn't it? Mm. Oh, and Highland cattle. The two of the necessary things to be here. They'd all have their pictures. And there were two or three bars there. Things.
Did you enjoy Stanley?
Oh yes, that was quite fun. Well, we went along to sort of Falkland Islands store and half a dozen of us, or perhaps not quite as many. Got a bit of food and went for a couple of days, marching off to the other end of the island. Which was quite fun.
When you got back to Britain, you'd left FIDS at that point.
Tell me. We've then had, I think, one or two changes in location, but we were there was lots of work to do on the records we'd taken. And both Joe and I have housed first, I think, in Crown Agents and then in, I think, moved around a couple of times to work on this. And in fact, Joe, coalesced, as it were, into him being in charge of running that side of FIDS, initially to have an organisation part of Edinburgh University, and in which, if I wanted to, I could have probably stayed there as well.
Who else was in the building? I think Ann Todd was there and Fuchs.
Sorry?
Who else was in the building? I think Ann Todd was there and Fuchs.
Oh!
Sloman?
Oh, yes. Yes, he was there, yes. I don't remember. Yes, he was the person that was around all the time, because he was the one that because I think he was originally part of Crown Agents too, and so we would have been somewhere with, because we used to go out, Bill Sloman, Joe and myself, for a sandwich or a beer lunch.
What did he make of Sir Vivian, or Vivian as he would have been then?
Hmm?
What did he make of Vivian Fuchs?
Well, I didn't really come across him very much. No, because we might have been working under some scientific bureau or something, but we wouldn't have been involved with him.
And Ann Todd?
Yes, she was there. Yes.
What was she like?
Oh, she was fine, though, yes. Yes, she's still around here.
Yes.
A remarkable lady.
So how long did you have to write up your results?
I can't quite remember how long I had, but that was my choice. It could have extended indefinitely, as it was with Joe Farman. That was a year or 18 months or something like that, I don't.
And then he left FIDS to embark upon two other careers.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yes, I think I got a short job in Chelmsford with an English Electric valve company and didn't really get on very well and went from there into teaching.
Was that better?
Oh, yes, I enjoyed that. Well, it mattered. You know, you were doing something that it mattered that you were doing it, as it were, which I couldn't feel that way about the other work I was doing.
You were in teaching for a couple of decades, then in 1980 you returned to Bass. What was it that attracted you to come back to Bass?
Well, I'd always been interested, and I'd always had the thought that if things had turned out differently, I might have been, you know, might have been there. And yeah, I can sort of say there was some dissatisfaction with the teaching. It was the senior people and the extracurriculum stuff that I really liked, rather than the routine classroom business. And I could look at where I was in 1980, as it were, and thought, well, this is going to sort of carry on for the rest of the time in this rather boring way. I think I might have been wrong in that assumption. And so I sort of got itchy feet.
Did you feel that Bass had changed much in those 20 years?
Oh, yes. Yes.
In what way?
Quite a bit. I went down after a year or so to see what was going on in the bases, and, you know, for the work I was doing. And the hut had improved a bit. There was more individual cubicles for people to sleep in. That was all a bit more bit more civilised and a lounge and bar. Oh, I think it was upstairs. But that, really the big change came after the Falklands War, because then the communications were put on a completely different footing, and, you know, it then became much easier to send much more information. And that was one of the biggest changes, I think, that had been from when I was there, is the change in, you know, time you could spend, you could... People phone up their families. I don't know that I'd have wanted to.
But did you think the ethos of Bass was the same as it had been in your FIDS days, or was it evolving as well?
Oh, it was evolving. But I think the evolving since I joined Bass in 1980 has been much bigger than it would have been between when I was first there and 1980. Well, that's a guess.
Well, you were there for 13 years, weren't you, I think?
Yeah.
So you did see it change a lot.
Yes, although yes, but it was, so many different things.
Well, give me a couple of examples of how it changed. Was it less friendly, more professional?
Yes, more professional in a way, and there was many more, although that work was done at Argentine Island, carried on in much the same way for collecting data for other people, but it became much, much more geared towards people doing their own research projects and going down and possibly even just going down for the summer. But that would have been at places like Rothera for the geologists and whatever the other one was where the biologists went. But of course... When I went down in the first time, then, not, of course, where I was, but sledge dog trips by people doing surveying was one of the major things that, you know, people were doing. And that, of course, has vanished completely here.
Yeah.
Nobody travels around, you know, for that. Ah, because it was could all be done by aeroplane and things.
What was your job that you actually applied for at Bass?
Well, it was to continue and try and sort out some of the publication of the values of some of the work that some of the geomagnetic work that had carried on for quite some time, and then for training the people that were going down.
How was training young fiddlers compared to working with students in a school?
Oh, rather different, much more informal. And we'd go away initially up to the Shetlands, and then somehow somebody decided that we were being a bit indulgent and it was a bit expensive, and so we went. Found somewhere where the same equipment was and took them up there.
Had you had to apply for this job, or were you asked?
Oh, I applied.
Yeah. What do you remember of the second interview then, in 1980? What do you recall of this interview in 1980?
Oh, the one that I got the job from. That would have been similar. That would have been a Bass, but that would have been a Bass interview. And there would have been Joe, there would have been Bill Sloman, and there would have been, can't think of his name for the moment, the chap that had been head of that division, Piggott. a very idiosyncratic character.
Tell me what
he was going out as I was coming in, although he stayed around, but he was no longer the head of the group.
Everybody smiles when his name comes up.
Yeah.
Tell me about him. What are your memories of Roy Piggott?
No, I don't really, because I had very little direct to do with him. No, I, you know, I would have been aware of all sorts of things, but I can't put my finger on anything at the moment.
So was the job mainly teaching next year's geophysicists?
It was partly that and partly continuing and trying to tidy up and be able to publish, you know, hourly values or whatever it was we were doing for all the magnetic work that had been going on, which was quite a big backlog of that. And when that was all done, it was a bit empty.
So you made two or three trips back south again?
Yes. Yes, mostly summer. Yeah, just for the summer to go around and check on things, because there was, by that time, the geomagnetic stuff which I looked after. There were three bases where that went on. The Halley Bay, which had originally been Independent Royal Society, mm-hmm. was a Bass base, and so was Grytviken, until the Argentinian business went, and then that became a military place. And I'm not sure whether we ever went back there. I don't think we, you know, in any formal way. I don't think so. I know I went back and did some measurements there.
Did you sense that the Antarctic had changed as well in those 20 years?
Oh, heavens, yes. From the point of view of the peninsula and the Argentine islands, there was much, much less snow around. And it wasn't very pleasant because of the hill on the top, which was all, you know, had quite deep snow. It would pack down, but it sort of melted away, and there was sort of icy bits, which are not nearly as much fun for skiing. Because that particular year, one or both of them, I think, were as cold as unusually cold, and had, you know, rather more fixed sea ice than has existed before since then. But apart from that, you know, it's all been getting warmer.
Did you notice that the warming in your first trip, in your second spell at Bass, that the ice had retreated between your
I think by then I could see on the Argentine Islands, which I knew very well, the permanent snow and ice cover was considerably less than it was.
Had FIDs changed? Were the people different who were going south?
The people at the Argentine Island base, no, well, they were similar, because it was similar work being done with similar people. But for places like Rothera, then it would have been different because of the travelling, and they'd have, you know, there wouldn't have been any geographical mapping work. It would all be technical stuff that geologists were doing. So that, you know, that Rothera, which was the main base for that, was quite a different place from what it had been in when I first went down.
Do you think you fitted back into the organisation okay, or or did it feel strange?
Possibly a bit odd. More so later on, when there was an opportunity which I didn't manage to do, to have done some research of my own, but didn't quite work out.
What, can you expand on that? What were you hoping to do?
Oh, no, I wasn't necessarily hoping to do anything. It was that the opportunity, well, it was more than, not quite so much the opportunity coming up, but the ethos had changed in the way it worked, and without doing my own research project, I wouldn't, you know, I wasn't considered doing as well. But that's a difficult subject. I don't really want to.
Okay,
fair enough. Very much.
I'm just wondering, so in those 13 years of your second spell, was your job fairly standard throughout the whole period, or did it change a lot?
It tended to change because the backlog I got rid of, the teaching of people was that carried on in a similar way, but I'm not quite sure. There's a space for something I can't quite remember what.
It seems to me, talking to other FIDs, that the organisation changed with the change of director. So when Dick Laws retired...
Oh, yes, I think it probably did, because he was totally opposed to ladies on the base.
What was your view on that?
I was doubtful about it being... You know, permanent wintering, but for visitors and people, whereas Fuchs, I think he virtually wouldn't allow his wife to go down or to get off the ship. And I think that sort of, he got pushed a bit because I think a chief engineer or somebody, you know, said, well, it's sort of seaman's tradition that wives can come, senior people can come on board. But then after he'd left, it, you know, that side of it changed. Although I don't think the ladies had started actually wintering on any of the bases before I left. They'd certainly, one or two appeared working in, you know, in Bass.
Do you think it presented problems, the inclusion of women?
I wouldn't know because I've not been involved since that's happened.
Yeah. Okay. So, but your training of geophysicists, that carried on throughout your entire 13 years.
Yes.
And so you were having to keep up with the changes in the science then, weren't you?
Well, actually, the science was much the same. I think some of the instruments had changed slightly, but I think the magnetic ones particularly that take up the most time, you know, with the photographic paper and things, that was still being done that way, much to the annoyance of the head of department who thought this was appallingly old-fashioned. And it did change eventually. Although, in fact, that base that I was at, the work vanished because of... The base was closed and it was sold to the Ukrainians, I think it was.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. And the quality or the nature of the new recruits coming into your training sessions, were they changing? Were they becoming more?
No, I think they were similar. Yes, I don't think there was a great change because it was the same sort of people.
Yeah.
People that just and we were interviewing them, so we were choosing, but they were by and large new graduates, some straight after, or even going on the interview before they'd taken their degree. But, you know, there's a thing, instead of doing not a sabbatical year, but you know what I mean, people did after...
Gap year.
Yeah, that's right. And a sort of gap year, as it were.
So you were actually on the interview panel for these new recruits, were you?
Oh yes, yes, yes. That had stayed it that way all the time, and so was somebody that was dealing with the ozone and meteorological side.
Did you produce any papers?
Did I?
Yeah.
Very little, no. I had a couple of things in the Polar Record or something, but they were mostly... and rather more weighty books with all the summaries of all the results, but...
Julian Parent and you wrote a paper in 1983 about the movement of the Brunt ice sheet. Is that...
Oh, yes, yes. Well, that's the point, because, in fact, this shows out one thing, and that perhaps, you know, with better management or more encouragement, I might have done something else. But this was something that Charles Swithenbank had suggested I did. And so I looked at the... I had about three ways of telling how the shelf that they were, that the base was on, was moving. There was an anomaly in the geomagnetic somewhere. I don't remember now. I can't. I've got the book somewhere, but there were about three different ways I could look at this, and so I produced a thing deducing the movements of the of that ice shelf, which I think have been found. So I've been told, found useful on several occasions since then. And that was encouragement from Charles Swithenbank to do that work.
Was this in any way early evidence of global warming that you were observing?
Well, the whole place had got warmer, but I'm not sure that particular set of measurements I produced did that, because I'm not sure, there may have been something else, but I did produce a couple of papers, that's true, concerning the movement of the ice shelf, which was perhaps worthwhile and interesting, because it, which wouldn't necessarily normally have been done, tied up different methods of measuring this over a slightly different time period and managing to fit them together and show an overall movement.
Well, it was speeding up, wasn't it?
I don't think this was very large. I'd have to have a look now. I think that may have come later. Yeah, I think it's much bigger changes since I've left.
Yeah, okay. And Julian says... We kind of touched on this already, but Julian says, ask him about the joys of taking six fiddlers to the Shetlands. So was it a permanent joy or was it a headache?
I enjoyed doing it, yes. Yes, and we'd hire a car at the weekend and go off travelling, yes. No. I was sorry that when that got put a stop to. Oh, quite right in a sense that it was a rather extravagant way of doing things. But
what else do you recall from that second spell that's stayed with you and is of interest?
Well, there was although I wasn't on the team because there were the two different groups. You know, there was the whole performance of the ozone hole business.
What was it like at Bass at that time? Because the paper was produced, written in late 84, I think, wasn't it? But published... Yes,
I'm not quite sure.
Published six months later. So was there any anticipation at Bass that something big was about to explode?
There was something... But any of my comments, I think, would be off the record on that one.
All right, OK. But I don't mean you personally. I just wonder whether there was the Bass generally felt that there was something significant about to be published.
Oh,
anticipatory.
Joe and companies, you know, an awful lot of work and... man-hours of working out was produced, and I think John Dooney, his department at all, but I think he sensed that this was something quite important. But I think the Bass directorate didn't realise that this was going to be a, you know, what's the word?
Significant.
Something breaking, you know.
Breaking news.
Yes, it would have been, you know, quite an important thing.
It's Dick Laws, wasn't it, at that time?
I think it was,
yeah. Yes, he admits that when he saw the paper, it didn't mean much to him. It didn't. Yeah. Well, perhaps that's not fair. He didn't see the earth-shattering significance.
Yes, although a few people did.
Yeah. So there was somebody who's... There were those who saw it coming.
Yes. Yes.
The big news.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the world's eyes were turned towards Bass at that time, weren't they?
Hmm?
The world's media and the world's eyes were turned towards Bass and its geophysical programmes at that time.
Yes, yes.
Did that make a difference to what you were doing? Get more recruits? More applicants?
I don't think so. I can't.
Right.
My memory is not very good. I don't remember any in particular significant from the point of view of the other work.
When the time came to leave Bass finally, what were your feelings? Were you sorry to leave? Glad to get out?
I wouldn't say it was either of those. It was a bit more that... the sorts of things I was doing were disappearing, and therefore, you know, it seemed to fit in with my retiring. I don't know what I would have been doing if I, you know, if I hadn't have been at retiring age.
So the geophysical research work you were doing was coming to a close, was it? Oh. Or was it the
research work? No, well, the measurements would have been done different ways, and in fact, the idea of static stuff, because it almost coincided with the selling of the base to the
Argentinians, the Ukrainians.
Ukrainians, yes.
Yeah.
So the I wouldn't have had anything to do anyway.
Okay. Looking back over your life as a whole, how does the Antarctic and FIDS and Bass rate?
Oh, fascinating! You know, really, really glad I was, from the point of view of interesting things and great pictures and things. Oh yes, I've had a good time. Professionally, perhaps not terribly sensible, but I've enjoyed myself and had a good time.
I think quite a few of us can say that. Quite a few of us can say
yes,
that.
Yes.
It's been lovely, David. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Right.